So the point I'm trying to make is you don't even have to be convicted of a crime to lose your job in this constitutional republic. If this body determines that your conduct as a public official is clearly out of bounds in your role, because impeachment is not about punishment. Impeachment is about cleansing the office. Impeachment is about restoring honor and integrity to the office.
Yes, it is Friday, April 19th, 2019. Out of the mouths of babes. Yes, that was Lindsey Graham back in 1999 when he was in the House. Except it was Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, who had colluded with Monica Lewinsky in the Oval Office. Yep. Can't wait to hear from Senator Graham on this. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I usually talk to our Capitol Muckraker-in-Chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. Sean will not be here this week. We had planned to do the show this week together, but then I got this weird phone call from him this morning. He seemed like out of breath, and he was kind of like mumbling around and kept on mentioning something about a Good Friday pilgrimage and something about Representative Stephanie Borowitz, and then he just said he had to go, and I couldn't get a hold of him again after that. So spirit of the Easter Bunny got him, I think. On today's show, you might hear a little laughter or something. That's my daughter who's here. My kids are home today. And so they're out and about or around. But on today's show, it'll be a little bit more of a short show today. I was going to run through some of the news. It's been a big, big week. Today's show, the Mueller report drops. Yes, it is pretty damning for the Trump administration. The biggest challenge for the Democratic Party leadership now seems to be how to continue to fan the flames of Russian outrage while not pulling the impeachment trigger. But will calls for impeachment growing sharper by the day, I should say with calls of impeachment growing sharper by the day, you've got to wonder what kind of political gymnastics they will perform now that they have pretty much everything they said they needed to call for impeachment hearings. And yet still, Democratic House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer prefers to punt instead of exercising the House's constitutional oversight authority. Here you go. You know, once you lay down a kind of your line in the sand, and that sand gets crossed, you gotta do something about it. I don't know. This week, Bernie Sanders put Fox on its heels at a town hall in Bethlehem. I mean, you gotta have a Bernie Sanders revival moment on Fox News. Call and response at the end. You like Medicare for all? Yes. Like $15 minimum wage? Yes. It's incredible. This week also, Bernie Sanders says basically on his webpage, released that he will ban fracking and all new fossil fuel projects if he is elected president. And in the same vein, Elizabeth Warren calls for a ban on all new fossil fuel leases offshore and on public lands. Pretty cool. And, you know, I just got to say this. I got to agree with Doug Henwood on this one. That Henwood was writing in the Jacobin this week, and you know, look, his title of his article says it all. I can't believe Elizabeth Warren is losing to these guys, meaning people like Buttigieg and Biden and these kind of people. I mean, you got to say, look, I mean, even Doug Henwood in that piece says, you know, he disagrees with Warren on a bunch of things, and you know, recognize that you know he's a socialist, and he's recognized that Warren's not that, but. You know, you got to give her credit, man. It was like she's got some of the best proposals, the most thoughtful proposals that are out there. And hopefully this is going to actually, she's going to get even some more traction when we hit the debates. But we shall see. We shall see. As of now, Bernie Sanders still out in front. Kirsten Gillibrand, yep, uses, and I mean uses, Ilhan Omar to basically stake out her both-siderism creds. There you go. So now I guess we know which lane she's in. But when it comes down to it, Gillibrand is right in line with the official party line, as Democratic Party leadership is failing horribly when it comes to responding to attacks on Ilhan Omar. And it seems that the most progressive legislators have got Omar's back. This comes after a series of death threats. It's unbelievable. Stockton, California. This week begins an 18-month pilot project for a universal basic income. The pilot project will start with about 130 residents and about $500 a month, and we're going to see what the impact is going to be. This has been sponsored in part by some Silicon Valley gurus, so we've got to keep our eye on that one. And right on the brink, on the eve of the first strike in Rutgers history, the faculty win a huge contract, proving once again that organizing for power pays off. I got to talk to a couple of the folks, one of the negotiators and organizers from Rutgers this week, and it is quite an exciting thing. Amazing organizing going on there. Speaking of Pennsylvania, Sean had a bunch of stuff that he was going to put on, but, you know, given his, his pilgrimage thing, he never kind of put it in here. So we'll just kind of skip over. We'll look at some Next Gen. Next Gen is actually doing some serious organizing on the ground in Pennsylvania. Activists are getting students at Penn State registered to vote ahead of a special election in the PA-12. Now, this is actually a really interesting thing because in the PA-12, that's a pretty Republican-dominated district. The chances of the Democrat, Mark Friedenberg, winning that election is probably a serious uphill battle. But the folks at Next Gen are basically, look, we're registering students to vote, and we're going to organizing with our sights on 2020 because we realize that, again, organizing on the ground over time pays off. So even if they take the loss in the special election for the PA-12, they're already building up a whole kind of culture of organizing and culture of participation. So kudos to them. Next Gen was also held a town hall with newly elected U.S. Representative Chrissy Houlihan down on Westchester's campus. Again, same process. Pretty cool. Today's last call. It's all going to actually be in the same thing there today, though. But it was the final season of Star Trek Discovery. The season finale, my bad, of Star Trek Discovery last night, which was awesome. I actually watched it on the night with the launch this week. It was pretty good. It's the kind of thing that, just like the end of last season, has left me kind of wondering how I'm going to like it going forward. But they didn't disappoint last season. They haven't disappointed this season. So here we go. This week was also the launch of the final season of Game of Thrones. Yep, it's been a big week. Began watching Netflix's new series, Our Planet, featuring the iconic narration of David Attenborough. I'll tell you right now, it's only a couple episodes in, and it is a beautiful and a devastating nature show that places climate change front and center. The BBC also aired this week David Attenborough's special, Climate Change, The Facts. That came on Thursday, and I think it's available for about a month online. You can check out the link in the show notes. Naomi Klein, Avi Lewis teamed up with The Intercept to release, quote, a message from the future with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And that is a beautifully animated letter from an imagined future in which the Green New Deal passed and has been put into practice. And Free Will releases a brand new fruited IPA for you this Saturday on 420. 420. Maybe that's the pilgrimage. Slight is a double IPA with passion fruit, coconut, and a touch of vanilla. It's hopped with Eldorado, Azaka, and some Simcoe. And so it comes in, like lots of hops coming in there, but comes at its 9.1 ABV. It's available in cans on Saturday, both the Percocet and Peddler Village tap rooms. I want to remind everybody, tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. You can also check out his podcast, his daily podcast. Just download that on the Rick Smith Show Daily Podcast on iTunes, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast. And, you know, if we want a progressive future, we need a progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. I got to say, I mentioned this last week and come back to this week. This week, we're finalizing a summer internship with a student from Kutztown University who will be joining Raging Chicken Press this summer. I expect some really cool stuff come from him. And we also got it looks like we're going to have another writer coming from the Allentown area. And I'm going to kind of hold off. I'm not going to tell you names yet until everything is squared away. But I'm very, very excited. Very excited to have someone in the Allentown area that is not only, this is the key, right? So not only kind of interested in writing, but interested in building a kind of, you know, a kind of a media network and kind of like, you know, telling people about this stuff and getting other people involved. I mean, for me, that is probably the most important thing. And it's been, that's a hard thing to find, I got to say. You know, it's really difficult. I mean, the one thing I could say over the time that I've done Raging Chicken, it's the people that are good at this work and want to do this kind of work are few and far between. I think I started this with a little bit of an idealistic notion that, you know, there's a lot of people out there that, that want to do this. And, you know, when it comes down to it, you find out that, you know, the people that are dedicated to doing this kind of work, right, doing this kind of the reporting and building a sustainable media infrastructure is kind of few and far between. And, you know, and I think this is, as I've said before, and part of the result of you know, progressives and the left's real kind of lack of and a long-term vision and organizational commitment to building its own progressive media networks, progressive you know, think tanks and supporting its intellectuals and journalists and so on. But, you know, again, I think that the tide is starting to turn. I've got so much hope for the younger generation, especially after seeing the organizing post-2016. It's been absolutely amazing. So here we go. Here we go. I'm excited for the summer. So, you know, if you want to help support these new writers coming on, I hope everybody saw that Dorcas Olatunji, she has published her second piece here in Raging Chicken. She's one of our newest members and probably our youngest writer that we've ever had aboard, writing from Delaware, again, on some climate change stuff. You know, I see really exciting things here. So if you can help support these kind of like emerging writers and, in a, you know, keeping a sustainable progressive media network growing by becoming a member of Raging Chicken, just go to patreon.com/rcpress, choose your membership level. You become a member as little as $5 a month. All right, so that's about it, everybody. That is kind of the elongated intro. A few things just to kind of touch on today. Like I said, we'll keep this one a little bit shorter, give you a little bit of the news breakdown. But I think that it's going to be very interesting. I mean, already actually going into the show today, I was looking at the like news that was breaking and comments on what's happening. And, you know, things are moving very, very quickly now. The Mueller report dropped yesterday, the 400 plus pages. And, you know, you had this dog and pony show that took place earlier in the day, you know, before the report was released. You know, you had the I got dog and pony show about, you know, this is no big deal, no big deal. You know, Bill Barr is like basically saying, you know, there's, you know, nothing to look at here. And, you know, you look at the report and it is pretty damning. You know, I've read some of the executive summaries so far. I'm going to try to make it through the rest of the report this week. But there's some great reporting. We've got a whole bunch of links in the show notes today. They'll take you some different reporting that's worth checking out. Some of the kind of key takeaways from the New York Times and Vox, some good reporting on NPR, and a direct link to what the New York Times has done, I think, is really extraordinary. Has actually put up a copy of it that's searchable and linked. So it allows you to kind of get through that in a much more manageable way. But, you know, at the end of it, right, the one thing that Sean and I have talked a lot about on the show, and I've been kind of asserting for as long as I can know, you can see, you know, some folks doing the same thing, is like, look, the Trump administration, if you understand from the get-go, the Trump administration as essentially organized, like organized crime is organized, you don't have a whole lot of huge expectations that there's going to be this smoking gun that it's going to prove conspiracy. Right. That's going to prove that, you know, that the Russians and the Trump campaign sat down and came up with an agreement. Right. And there's these email trains that show you that they planned all this stuff together. I've always thought that's been very, very unrealistic. But the way that this takes place, right, the way that the coordination took place between Russia and the Trump administration. You can see this kind of like laid out in the Mueller report. You know, the Mueller report basically says, look, we don't find kind of criminal conspiracy. Everybody talks about collusion, they say in the report, but collusion is not a term of law. It is not a term of art. We don't use that term. So what our standards were criminal conspiracy, right, which is a pretty high bar because you have to have that smoking gun. And they say, like, no, but they were kind of mutually reinforcing, mutually benefiting actions that were taking place on the Russian side and on the Trump campaign side. And there were direct contacts between between the Trump campaign and the Russian campaign. Now, what does this mean? I think, frankly, when reading, there's two volumes of this report. And the first volume deals with the kind of direct coordination with Russia. And one of the things that's most, I think, concerning about the volume one, the one that's going to deal specifically with Russia, has to do with the fact that the Mueller report shows that the Russia had been active since 2014 in planning to kind of undermine democracy in the United States, to undermine the electoral system in the United States, and they had been actively planning for that. The associating with the Trump campaign, according to this report at least, didn't come until later. So they were already active in there, and the Trump kind of came in there, and they were like, hey, you know what? This is actually going to further advance our our agenda. So that shows you kind of what we're going to have to contend with down the road in terms of the manipulation of our mind space that we saw on social media and so on. There have been some other reporting this week. This is not specifically – well, at least I have not read this directly in the Mueller report. This may have been the case. I know this has been leaking out before, but that it's been shown that a lot of the people that were targeted in particular around the election, the Trump election, were Bernie Sanders supporters, especially after Bernie Sanders lost the primary. And really fanned the flames of the kind of anti-Clinton hysteria to try to ensure that the Sanders folks, that at least a sizable contingent or significant contingent of the Sanders supporters would either not vote, would vote third candidate, or vote for even for Trump. And I remember, you know, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you might have heard, remember me talking about this. I remember being down in Philadelphia for the Democratic National Convention in 2016. And it was a really bizarre feeling. I mean, I was not inside the convention center. I was interested in covering the protest. If you remember, there was a lot of stuff that was going on about what was going to happen with superdelegates, there about the role that the DNC played in kind of like trying to minimize or trying to undercut Bernie Sanders. So there was a lot of anger and resentment about that kind of stuff, and there was also a lot of people that just wanted to hold the Democratic Party accountable to its own terms. So, but anyways, I never forget this one moment where I was standing up on this planter, kind of doing some images and some video of the crowd. And there was this truck with one of those electronic billboards on it, right, that kind of scrolls and messages. And the message was basically pictures of Hillary Clinton and saying things like, lock her up, lock her up, lock her up, right? And at first I was thinking like, well, what is this? Trying to understand what was going on. At first I actually thought it was a critique of Donald Trump, because that had been, part of his campaigns. But then what blew my mind is that among all these activists that were watching this truck go by down below me, there was a really significant contingent that as that truck went by with that billboard and Hillary Clinton said, lock her up, they began chanting along with it. Lock her up, lock her up. Right. So there had been, and these are like left folks, right? Left and even radical folks who were chanting Trump slogans outside there. And I remember just a sense of just disorientation about this. In some of the ways, and again, I have no evidence to show there's a direct correlation between those two exact events, but I think that was the kind of the hope that the Russians had and kind of in the lead up to the 2016 election. So that kind of idea that what's happening on social media, what's happening in kind of the ways that we are organizing and communicating, right? Especially when we have over-reliance upon social media as our primary source of organizing, the ability to manipulate that space by people with not good intentions is most concerning. So that's the volume one part that I thought really significant. And the thing was, is that the way that you saw Russia and the Trump administration act is it's like you would in any kind of mob families, right? You know, if you know a mob boss wants something done, the mob boss doesn't kind of write a memo and make in duplicate and then send an email to somebody and say go off this person, right? Or I need you to make this drug drop. Right. I mean, what they do is that they kind of they let it be known in no uncertain terms. Right. They like kind of almost like I'm just thinking it would be a good idea if we had a way to, you know, meet a truck or something like, you know, that person's just causing a problem. And there are people that are associated with that organization that then will carry that out because they understand what the implication is. This is essentially what Michael Cohen said in his testimony. Right, but you knew what Trump wanted done, and you had people like Michael Cohen who would carry that stuff out. Now you also have like Putin in Russia is operates on the same model, right? I mean, it's essentially an entire country organized around through this kind of organized crime, mentality, and so to expect that there was going to be some kind of smoking gun, I think was just like, you know, wishful thinking. And frankly, you know, it was the kind of thing that got cultivated, I think, in a lot of kind of mainstream Democratic circles. This thing that the Mueller report was going to be like the end all be all, that we weren't going to have radically transform our economy. We weren't going to have to radically transform the way that the Democratic Party does business. No, we're just going to have this one guy, the superhero model again. This one guy is going to come in and he's going to produce the report, and then that's going to solve everything. Because really, it's just about Trump. It's not about everything. And again, this has never been the position of us on this show or of Raging Chicken or a lot of the folks on the progressive left. So, so again, that wasn't so surprised. There's a lot of letdown happening out there, which is again, okay, you know, that's of your own doing as far as I'm concerned. The second part, however, on the obstruction of justice charges, I think, at least from my reading and what I've read so far and some of the reporting I've been reading, that I think it's a fair judgment to say that what Mueller essentially has done in that section was to kind of mimic what happened during the Richard Nixon investigation, is that provide a roadmap to call up articles of impeachment. Right. 11 items under that, how he obstructed justice, and basically says directly that, look, we accept what the Justice Department says, that the Justice Department will not kind of indict a sitting president. Right. Now, we can agree or disagree with that reading of it. Right. But that's what Mueller has said. Right. Instead, the appeal was directly to saying that there are constitutional mechanisms. We do not want to undercut constitutional mechanisms for removing a president, or they didn't say removing a president, but for holding the president accountable. And under the Constitution, that is letters of impeachment. Right. That is kind of the move towards impeachment and investigation under impeachment. Right. Now, if you recall, if you've been paying attention, is that the Democrats, the mainstream Democrats, Democratic leadership has been getting a lot of mileage out of the Russian investigation and the Mueller investigation. And they've been playing a game in my estimation. And the game has been they want to keep people riled up and want to keep people focused on Trump and want to basically say that Mueller is going to kind of provide the answer to all. But really what they're trying to do is they're trying to use these investigations as a way of undercutting Trump in order to kind of build towards 2020. Right. And I don't think that's necessarily the worst strategy. Right. However, when you start saying that Mueller is going to solve everything, right, that report is going to kind of be so damning at that point we're going to have to consider articles of impeachment. This is essentially what Nancy Pelosi has said. We're going to have to wait for the Mueller report. Lots of Democratic leadership, yeah, we're going to have to wait for the Mueller report, and then we make a decision. Well, here's the report. And it provides a roadmap. It's extraordinarily damning. And Mueller basically hands this with all but saying, you know, written with a, you know, like a directed note, say, here's how you impeach the president. And now you see all this backtracking on the part of the Democratic leadership. Now, again, we can have a debate. And I'm mixed on the effectivity of moving forward with impeachment at this point. Although I think it becomes a more difficult case to make not to begin pursuing or at least investigating or moving towards impeachment, but because of the way what the results of this report and what the groundwork has been said so far. However, there's some dangers there too as well, political dangers. But let's be clear, those are political dangers, and they're not necessarily about exercising the constitutional authority of oversight that is expected by the House. And what's complicated things here is that the House or the Democratic Party leadership has been trumpeting the stuff about oversight and the need to oversight and the need to exercise a constitutional authority as a co-equal branch of government. Now they're basically being called to the mat and say, you got to do something. And all this backtracking, like Steny Hoyer, for example, he told Dana Bash this week on CNN, he basically said, quote, based on what we have been seeing to this date, going forward on impeachment is not worthwhile at this point. Very frankly, there is an election in 18 months and the American people will make a judgment. Right. So basically, I mean, I don't know how you read that other than a punt. It said, you know, we want our authority. We want to do oversight. We want to do this. But when it comes right down to it, making a hard call, we're going to punt to the American people. Right. That's the Steny Hoyer position. And I think that becomes more difficult. You saw even AOC come out this week now saying, hey, look, given what's in Mueller report, I don't see how we don't make steps in those directions, considering impeachment. And of course, Rashida Tlaib has been calling for this right from the get-go. In a sense, she ran on this. So we're going to see a further divisions within the Democratic Party, about what to do at this point. And we'll see how it plays out. I mean, I don't want to necessarily say what direction it's going to go because I'm not clear on that. We can have a question about we can game out the possibilities. What happens if impeachment is pursued at this point? Will that kind of help Trump, or will that in the 2020 election, or will that actually help Democratic challengers? My position on this is always like, well, it depends on what the message is, and depends on what the organizing looks like. Right? It's not like impeachment by itself doesn't automatically lead to one thing or another. Right. It has everything to do with the kind of organizing that's taking place on the ground. Right. And the ways that the decisiveness through which the party pursues its actions. What will not fly, in my estimation, is wishy-washiness. Right. Or what appears to be hypocrisy. Right. That is the kind of stuff that you might as well drive a stake in your own heart when it comes to 2020. So my opinion on that. Amazing, you know, it seems like a month away now, but this past Monday, I guess it was on tax day, not only did Bernie Sanders release his 10 years of his taxes, which was kind of cool move to do this, release the taxes 10 years on tax day ahead of a Fox town hall, which you could certainly imagine that was going to be one of the talking points on Fox. You haven't released your taxes yet. You demand the president is. Instead, he kind of ups the game. 10 years of taxes and right before the Fox News. That was pretty cool. What was unexpected, I think unexpected by anybody, was that Bernie Sanders, instead of this was a Fox town hall, Fox picked the crowd. The Fox hosts were right there saying that, hey, look, this is a mixed ideological crowd. That's how they kind of opened up and, you know, said, hey, let's see what happens. How many people here? when Brett, what's his face? Merrick said, basically says, how many people here get their insurance through their employer? And like nearly everybody raises their hand, right? Because he's talking about Medicare for all. Says, how many of you would consider transitioning to have the government kind of take over and, you know, do the thing? And like nearly everybody in that room raised their hands and cheered. And I think that right there was the signal that this was not going to go the direction that Fox thought it was. The fact that it starts with that and ends with, say, Bernie Sanders basically saying, look, I'm going to close out. Like, we basically agree on things. We basically agree that we should have a living wage of 15. You know, we should all have a living wage and raise the minimum wage to make a living wage. And people are like, yes, we should. People said that everyone should have health insurance. Yes, we should. That we should. And he was like, you know, it was literally like a call and response. With an audience, you thought, I think a lot of people kind of watching that could have easily mistaken that for a Bernie Sanders rally, as opposed to a Fox's attempt to kind of, you know, undercut the Sanders campaign. So, man, kudos. There was a lot of skepticism about Bernie going on Fox and doing that. But I basically think he just showed us how it's done. And the one thing we know that is how it's done is basically by, you know, having an agenda, right? An agenda that is actually popular with people and that you've been advocating for in a consistent way. The other thing I say, you know, Elizabeth Warren, it continues to tear it up when it comes to policy stuff this week. it is concerning, like Doug Henwood said, that she is a little bit behind in the pack. We could talk a lot about, you know, in future about why that might be. And, you know, I've always thought that she's probably not the the best campaigner. But in terms of like policy and her advocacy and her consistency and her work ethic and her, you know, where she is on the issues, I mean, Elizabeth Warren is pretty and a pretty amazing candidate. I'm just hoping that when we get to the debates, she's going to have some breakthroughs there. So we've got a couple months before we get there. Well, a little month and a half before we get there, before we get to the debates. But I hope that she's going to still be in it by then. Because some of the traction that Mayor Pete, or like Pete Buttigieg, is getting this week is troubling by comparison. Because he's, I think him, it's all about affect. It's a particular segment of you know, the Democratic Party. You know, it's basically these people, you know, who
oh, he's a doctor.
Yep, remember Michelle Wolf on that one?
People think you might flip the House and Senate this November, but you guys always find a way to mess it up. You're somehow going to lose by 12 points to a guy named Jeff Pedophile Nazi Doctor. Oh, he's a doctor.
Yeah, exactly. Like Pete Buttigieg hits all those kind of like professional class buttons, right? It ticks all those boxes. And I think that's one of the reasons why he's getting all the traction he has. I think he's like even a safer Obama in some ways. And that is appealing to some nostalgia that Democratic centrists have. And it's a bit concerning to me, especially when you're talking about the challenges of climate change, of wealth inequality, and so on. Given his record of gentrification and stuff as mayor of South Bend and some of his positions. I mean, even though he's getting – it's interesting because he's getting traction out of a essay that he wrote was in high school, I guess, which was like Profiles in Courage, and he wrote it on Bernie Sanders. And that keeps on getting brought up in a variety of different media. And yet now he's on clearly in the anti-Bernie Sanders camp. So we'll see how that plays itself out. Couple notes. Kirsten Gillibrand, basically looking to both condemn Ilhan Omar and the Trump administration to try to stake out this both-siderism crap. It's been really disturbing, and hoping when Sean's back next week, you know, when he gets back from his pilgrimage, we can dig into that a little bit more. Because I know he's got a lot to say about the way that the Democratic establishment, right, the leadership is actually treating Ilhan Omar. It runs completely counter to everything that, you know, even those in the like the centrist wing of the Democratic Party are supposed to stand for. And it's frankly, it's kind of disgusting. So I think we need to get behind Ilhan Omar, you know, get on her website, you know, donate to her campaign and send a message to your own legislator that you will not stand by and watch them leave her hang out to dry. It's pretty sick. Hold on. Cool thing this week at Stockton, California. They are beginning a 12-month pilot project about universal basic income. It's a very – now, we should say it's a very, very modest proposal. Like, you know, I shouldn't put it in those ways, modest proposal. But basically, you're talking about 130 residents are going to be receiving about $500 a month with no conditions, no strings attached, right? And that's the whole idea behind a UBI. Right, I want to leave this section a little bit of the section so you understand it, because it's a good thing to kind of watch for. It's only going to be 18 months, which is, you know, going to give us limited results. But there's a lot going on here. So this is from The Hill. Here you go. So quote, we are in a moment where big ideas are important and politically people are ready for them. Natalie Foster, co-chair of the Economic Security Project, told The Times. That is the one of the things that sponsored this. The Silicon Valley-based organization donated $1 million in initial funding for the program, about a third of its total budget. quote, the stories coming out of Stockton will put a real name and face on what the economic insecurity looks like and what it looks like to make a different political decision, Foster said. The first payments under the program were distributed on credit cards in February, with organizers soon able to collect data on how it was spent from a subgroup of storytellers, quote, among the recipients, according to the Times. While final results will not be available for the next few years, the program's backers hope will illustrate the progress with individual anecdotes as the data takes shape, according to the newspaper. And they say in the Hill, numerous Democratic contenders for the presidency in 2020 have proposed similar measures that include Sanders, Warren, and even Cory Booker. So Andrew Yang, of course, has been out in front on this. Andrew Yang has basically made his whole campaign based on UBI and wants to put that kind of front and center. His argument is for $1,000 a month as part of his platform. Even Kamala Harris has been, I don't know if she would actually propose this, but she's actually been talking about a monthly livable income to grant to working families. We'll see what that means in practice, though. But the fact that you've got things like Medicare for All, free college tuition, a UBI, and the Green New Deal are going to be some of the terrain on which these this primary season is going to be fought over is absolutely astounding to me. So, the best possible way. The key thing to watch out with UBI, if you're not familiar with UBI, Universal Basic Income, is that you've got supporters. If you just think about who supports a UBI, it looks like really, really strange bedfellows, because you've got those folks that are coming out, say, for example, from Silicon Valley, not all of them, but a lot of them from Silicon Valley, especially the ones with the libertarian bent. They see UBI as basically a replacement for social programs like Social Security and food stamps and everything like this. So it's like you swap out social programs for universal basic income. There's others, which I say that is a proposal that I am, especially if you're talking about $1,000 a month, I am definitely not a supporter of that. However, some of the other proposals, the more well thought out ones, if you look at the ones that they discuss in the Green New Deal, for example, that $1,000 a month or $800 a month or however that gets, or $1,200, however it gets played out, is part of a social fabric, right? So it becomes your basic income and universal health care, right? And free college tuition, right? Or tuition-free college or whatever. Those things are important there, right? So it becomes part of the social fabric, part of the social welfare system, part of the social democratic future, as opposed to a way of turning everything into some sort of libertarian hellscape. So that's really important to work out. Now, Dissent magazine, a few months back, we talked a little about this on the show before, Dissent magazine put out a really good analysis of some of the things to watch out for in UBI. If I can pull it up, and I'm thinking about it when I'm doing the editing for today's show, I'll stick a link in there too as well to check it out. But if I had to put on the top list of things that, you know, what you really want to be digging in and what the candidates' positions are in terms of 2020, it's got to be where they stand on the Green New Deal and what they mean by that, where they stand on Medicare for All and what they mean by that. Don't be bought off by people who promise to have like affordable health care or access to affordable health care. Those are signal words when you talk about access, especially, or affordable, right? That just basically says tweaks with the private insurance industry, which has been devastating to so many people. That is not Medicare for All. And yes, people like Pete Buttigieg say there's multiple ways to get there. We need to fix Obamacare and all that. That is a centrist Democratic Party pollster tested messaging campaign. It has nothing to do with actually getting people the health care that they need. So just always have that in mind. When you hear access to health care or affordable health care, always, you know, challenge people when you can. Say, where do you stand on Medicare for All as laid out by, right, Pramila Jayapal, for example, or by Bernie Sanders, for example, or by Elizabeth Warren? You know, where do you stand on those proposals specifically? That's the only way we're going to get to do it. I think the Green New Deal is the other real big one, is that, or is probably the biggest one. That is like the make or break. We've got less than 12 years now to have like nearly, you know, get us to zero emissions, basically. If we kind of want to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. So Green New Deal, not like we need a greener economy or we need to have more hybrid technology or more green technology. No. Where are you in the Green New Deal? Because the Green New Deal addresses all those things. And if you want to know why it's so important to do, if you just look at what just happened with Kentucky this week, I'm going to forget the guy's name, but a Republican from Kentucky was basically seeing like he was calling like AOC's bluff on the Green New Deal. Was like, yeah, you got this Green New Deal, so why don't you come out here and talk to miners? I invite you to come out here and talk to the miners about what the impact is going to be, right? And the assumption was is that she was not going to come, right? But she accepted the invite. She's, I'd be more than happy to, because the Green New Deal, as it stands, of course, right, addresses those replacement. And it doesn't do it like in the Obama way, right? It doesn't do it in the New Democrat way, which says, oh, we're going to provide job training for those who want it. No. It recognizes if we are going to transition off fossil fuels, right, people are going to lose their jobs in the coal mines because we will no longer be mining coal. And the solution to that is not to, one, like, just offer, like, hey, here's an invite for job retraining, right? What does it mean to retrain for, like, a new, what, like, high-tech job when you're 55 years old or 50 years old, even 45 for that matter? I mean, give me a break, right? No, it basically says, look, we're going to provide jobs with a job guarantee, number one, right, in the infrastructure changes that need to take place, right? So in my mind, if you think about things like, well, if we need to have solar plants, well, then the government should be actually directly kind of building those solar plants, right, or building section in those areas, right, that are mostly impacted by the loss of coal jobs, right? And here's, you have your job guaranteed here. Or if you're later on in your career, right, in the Green New Deal, they say, look, we may just need to buy out your contract. You know, like they do with CEOs when they want to get rid of a CEO, or if you look at like what they've done at my university, at Kutztown University, so on, when they want to get rid of a bad actor, they just pay off, they buy out their contract. Here's the same kind of stuff. Basically, look, we're going to have a transition, right? And yes, you're going to have directly impacted. So what we're going to do is that we're going to buy out your contract, right? We are going to pay you a salary, right, that will allow you to keep your standard of living as you have it, if not better. Right. And that's what you need to do. And that's part of the cost of that switch to the Green New Deal, which is accounted for within that. So those folks just aren't left out to dry. That has been the worst, the worst aspect of the New Democrats, when they pretend that like just education and job training is actually what is going to get people out there. And anybody who's at the in a marginal community, in a precarious economic situation, knows that there's a load of crap. Right. And find that it's absolutely disgusting when people foreground job retraining as a solution. So, all that stuff. So AOC is going to go out and basically make that case to the miners. And then what happens? Well, that Republican legislator is like, oh, nope, cancel the event, because called her bluff. And it turns out wasn't a bluff. She was serious. And now they're going to walk away because they are afraid, because they know when miners look, a lot of these miners are union miners. Right. So they have a certain understanding of kind of like economic justice, right, and organization, and when what's bullshit and what's not. And when they hear that, when they hear her come out and make the case and hear people come out and make the case, these legislators are going to be scared, because their constituents that they've been kind of fanning the flame say, no, keep your black lung, defend black lung at all costs, keep those coal jobs. Right. Because they told these people that's the only thing that they're capable of doing. And if AOC comes in and basically says that all of you are better than this and our society needs you now, our society is basically saying that you have paid more than your price, right? This addiction to fossil fuels has cost your families generations of their lives and health. No more, right? That's a powerful message. It's a powerful message. So that's that. A lot of cool stuff going on, like I mentioned, with Next Gen. We'll probably get to that at some another point. I want to give a huge shout out to the folks down at Rutgers. They were on the brink, and like Rutgers, 200 plus year history, had never had a strike. And they were right on the eve of a strike when once again the administration realized, oh, they're not joking. For real, they're not joking. So there was a flurry of last minute negotiation on a contract that the administration basically said it was not budging. The faculty basically won like almost all of their demands for that contract. They avoided the strike. They have a tentative contract now. Now, the membership still needs to vote on it, so it's not a 100% done deal yet. But it was a huge victory. And I had the opportunity on Thursday to talk to one of the negotiators and another of the organizers from the Rutgers campaign. And it was heartening to hear the kind of organizing that they did on the ground, and you know, basically them echoing the same kind of stuff we've been hearing from those victorious educational struggles across the country, that it is direct action and organizing which gets the goods. And nothing short of that, nobody will save us but ourselves. So we have to organize to win. So congratulations to those folks at Rutgers. I should also say that, however, there are two different bargaining units. The adjunct faculty at Rutgers are also on this part of the same union, but they have a different bargaining unit, so they have a different contract. The adjunct contract has not yet been settled. So don't look away yet. If you've been sending your support to the folks at Rutgers, please continue to send your support to the adjuncts thing. See how you can help out down there. It's a huge campaign. So fantastic. So that's what we got. So when I come back, I was going to do a quick break here, and then we come back. We're going to hear. I'll just do a little very, very short last call for today. But want to remind everybody and thank everybody for tuning in today. And if you do see run into Sean out there, make sure he's all right, because, you know, what he exactly means by what he means by a pilgrimage and why. You know, why he's bringing up Stephanie Borowitz's name was a little bit disturbing this morning. So we'll come back with after today's little break. It's Kevin Mahoney. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For the past 7 years, Raging Chicken Press has brought pull no punches, progressive reporting and commentary to the interwebs. Our long-form investigative pieces, stories that no access journalist wants to touch, or rollicking weekly podcasts strive to advance progressive movements and perspectives rooted in the struggles happening across the country or down the street. We've broken national stories and caused our share of discomfort in the halls of power. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is to become a member of Raging Chicken today by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Thank you for your energy, your encouragement, and your support. Keep up the fight. Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. It's the last call. And yeah, the jig is up. If you stayed in after the break, just in case you had this nagging feeling I just had to give Sean a hard time today about, you know, he's gone on a pilgrimage in search of Stephanie Borowitz. That would be hilarious, especially since it is Good Friday. It seemed fitting. And he did have a good Catholic school education. I think you should have, if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that Sean's position on religion is not one that is conducive to pilgrimages with Stephanie Borowitz. But still, but if you do see Sean, put on the straightest face that you have and ask him about, like, what's up with his pilgrimage with Stephanie Borowitz, because I guarantee you he's not going to listen to this podcast, so he won't know what the heck you're talking about. It'll just be awesome if he gets a lot of people either tweeting at him or if they see him in person this weekend, to ask him about what's he doing hanging out with Stephanie Borowitz and what kind of pilgrimage did he exactly go on for Good Friday. And he won't know what you're talking about. It's going to be awesome. But that's pretty cool. But Sean is on his way back home for the weekend. I'm actually probably going to see him later today. He's apparently bringing me a beer load from the Harrisburg area, which I'm very psyched about. So we'll talk a little about that on next week's show. But real quick, last call for today. Star Trek Discovery last night. Whoop. Yep, it was the season finale. It was off the hook. It was, I mean, probably it had to be, just in terms of like special effects and stuff for a Star Trek series, it had to be the best like special effects episode in the history of Star Trek. It was just it was fantastic. It was fast moving. It was adventurous. They kind of brought the season to a close. I don't want to, in case you haven't seen it, I'm not going to do too many spoilers here. But they brought the season to a close. They kind of tied it up and then left us kind of like, well, okay, where does this go now? I almost feel like the end of this, the end of this season was kind of like where Voyager kind of began, right? You're kind of like in this unknown territories where we're going forward. So it was a kind of really cool kind of close out. So we'll see where we go. All, you know, kudos to all those folks who are working on Star Trek Discovery, because it's really awesome. Also, Game of Thrones, first episode in the final season came out on Sunday, and it was preparatory. Let's leave it at that. it was interesting, because I know it was kind of like I've been, you know, for Game of Thrones fans, waiting for this for a long time, and I think there were a lot of us who were expecting there to be the first episode to be longer, like 1.5 to 2 hours, as kind of like, especially since there's been a 2 year hiatus, like, or 1.5 year hiatus between when season 7 concluded. So it was kind of like getting it. It felt more like a warm up, like getting everything, everyone back up to speed and stuff, getting kind of the players in the right space, getting everybody up to the north, and laying the terrain for the story that's about to unfold. So that's kind of the way it felt. It was always great to see, you know, just to watch it again, because it's just a fantastic show. I believe. I was talking to my students about this too. Some of my students were bringing it up in class before class the other day, and so we were talking a little bit about it. And I was saying, you know, one of the things that you know, that you could check out is what the Game of Thrones is about. Like Martin, basically, when he's, I wish I could find the interview. At some point, I got to track this interview down. But I heard an interview with him, was talking about Game of Thrones is basically being kind of like a reimagining of this. Reimagining is the wrong word, but basically a series in the spirit of what you saw with Lord of the Rings or Narnia, right? The idea is that you were kind of reimagining this kind of epic journey, but doing it for like an American political cultural context, just in terms of the power dynamics and all that stuff that gets played out. And that's always been really intriguing to me. So it's, you know, thinking about the way that power plays out in something like Game of Thrones as being so significantly different than the way that power plays out in something like Lord of the Rings. And you could see such differences, right, between those things. So anyways, so that's launching this week. If you have not checked out Netflix's Our Planet, you need to do so. It's not the kind of thing that I think you really want to binge on, because it's both beautiful, as you know, if anybody's seen like Blue Planet, like, and those other nature shows that are BBC and stuff, they're just absolutely fantastic. Or National Geographic's got some of them. They're just fantastic. David Attenborough's, you know, his voice is legendary as the narrator for those shows. Well, he comes back for this, and he said the one thing that has always been missing from those other shows is any kind of discussion whatsoever is climate change. We just bought this fascination and beauty of nature. Well, that is there in Our Planet too as well. You've got the absolutely just gorgeous, like, cinematography. You've got these amazing animals and dynamics, except you start to see in here about the impacts that climate change is having on the animal populations, about the live climate, and some of it is just frankly devastating. You may have already seen the whole, clips that came out about the walruses who could no longer find ice, so they had to kind of basically climb these rocky shores, and they were falling off to their deaths, right? because of the melting of ice, right? And that is because of climate change. So, you know, it's not all like a downer, right? There's some part just still the beauty and fascination of kind of our natural world. But it puts that in conversation, direct conversation with the very real futures that we are living through now, actually, not even in the future. So that's pretty cool. I haven't seen this yet, but I've heard some good things about it. I'm going to watch it this week. David Attenborough's also had a special that aired on the BBC this on Thursday. It's called Climate Change, the Facts, which is also getting this kind of like, you know, people are like, because they associate his voice with just nothing but beauty. And they hear them talk about climate change is kind of having a huge impact there, too, as well. If you haven't seen the great collaboration with Naomi Klein, Avi Lewis, The Intercept, and Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, there's this great animated feature. It's beautifully animated, and it's basically her. She does the narration of the whole thing, and it's like as if she's like, well, I don't know, 10 years in the future or something like that, writing a letter back to the present, right? To where, you know, or writing a letter to someone about reflecting back upon the changes that have been made because of the Green New Deal. So it's kind of got this like sci-fi thing to it, right? Where you're kind of projecting on a possible future and looking back and what that actually looks like. And I think it's an extraordinary move as a way of engaging in this kind of cultural reframing about what this Green New Deal is and what's necessary. So definitely check that out. Last thing we'll put on the agenda for the day. Free Will's got a new release coming out tomorrow, Saturday, 4:20. It's a beer called Slight. And Slight is another fruited double IPA. It's got passion fruit, coconut, touch of vanilla. It's hopped with El Dorado, Azaka, and Simcoe. And this, as they describe it, this could easily be mistaken for a tropical coconut smoothie with a bit of tart from all the fruit. But the healthy additions of hops provide balance and remind you that it is, in fact, a beer. And it comes in at a pretty hefty 9.1 ABV. It's available in cans, 16-ounce cans, 4-packs, both at Percosy and Peddler's Village tap rooms. So, hey, everybody. I wish all of you a happy Passover and Easter for those of you who are celebrating those. I wish Sean, you know, Godspeed on his pilgrimage and hope he finds the Borowitz he's looking for. And for all the rest of you, I hope to hear from you, see you, hear you. Hope you'll be back, basically what I'm saying, next week when we return with Raging Chickens Out to Coop podcast. Here's to it, everybody. Keep up the fight. Don't get lost in Mueller. See ya!
So the point I'm trying to make is you don't even have to be convicted of a crime to lose your job in this constitutional republic. If this body determines that your conduct as a public official is clearly out of bounds in your role, because impeachment is not about punishment. Impeachment is about cleansing the office. Impeachment is about restoring honor and integrity to the office.